Chapter 5. The branch line train came to a stop. A small camouflaged station stood there in the sun. Of the few surrounding houses, only ruins remained. In their place, barracks had been erected with roofs and walls painted in protective colors. A number of railroad cars stood on the tracks. Russian prisoners were transferring freight. The branch line at this point joined a main line. The wounded were carried into one of the barracks. Those that could walk sat hunched on rough-hewn benches. A few more men on leave had arrived. They kept together and tried to be as inconspicuous as possible. They were afraid of being noticed and sent back. It was a weary day. Wilted light played tag over the snow. From a distance came the hum of airplane engines. It did not come from the air. Probably there was a concealed airfield nearby. Later, a squadron took off over the station and began to climb until it looked like a flight of larks. Graeber dozed. Larks, he thought. Peace. They were startled into attention by two military policemen.
Papers!
The MPs were healthy and strong, and had the confident bearing of men who were not in danger. Their uniforms were spotless, their weapons polished, and each of them weighed at least 20 pounds more than any of the men on leave. The soldiers silently brought out their certificates of leave. The MPs examined them methodically before returning them. Then they ordered the paybooks to be shown.
"You're to eat in Barracks 3, the older one said finally. "Clean yourselves up. What a sight you are. Do you want to arrive home looking like pigs?"
The group wandered across the barracks.
"These damned spying hounds," growled a man with a black, stubble-covered face. "Big mouths and a long way from the shooting. Act as if we were criminals."
"In Stalingrad, they shot dozens of men who got separated from their regiments," another man said.
"Were you at Stalingrad?"
"If I had been at Stalingrad, I wouldn't be sitting here now. No one got out of that stew."
"Listen to me," said one of the older non-coms. "At the front, you can talk any way you like, but from now on, you'd better shut your trap if you know what's good for you. Understand?"
They lined up with their mess pots.
For over an hour, they had to wait. No one left his place. They were cold, but they waited. They were used to it.
Finally, they were given a dipper full of soup with some meat and vegetables and a couple of potatoes floating in it. The man who had not been at Stalingrad looked around cautiously.
"I wonder if those MPs eat this stuff, too."
"Man, you have worries," said the non-com contemptuously.
Graeber swallowed his soup. At least it was warm, he thought. At home, it would be different. His mother would cook, perhaps even bratwurst, with onions and potatoes, and afterwards a raspberry pudding with vanilla sauce.
They had to wait until dark. Twice more they were inspected. More wounded kept arriving all the time. With each new batch, the men on leave became jumpier. They were afraid of being left behind.
Finally, after midnight, the train was assembled. It had grown colder and the stars hung big in the sky. Everyone hated them. They meant good visibility for the flyers. For a long time now, nature had had no significance in itself. It was simply good or bad in relation to the war, as protection or as danger. The wounded were put on board. Three were taken off again immediately. They had died in the meantime. The stretchers were left standing on the platform. The ones with the dead had no blankets. No light showed anywhere. Next came the ambulatory wounded. They were carefully checked. "We won't get in with them," Graeber thought. "There are too many. The train is full." He stared stolidly into the night. His heart pounded. Airplanes hummed above him. He knew they were Germans, but he was afraid. He was much more afraid than at the front.
"Men on leave!"
someone shouted finally. The group hurried forward. Military police were once more standing there. In the afternoon, during the last inspection, each man had received a slip of paper, which he now had to surrender. They climbed into a car. Some of the wounded were already sitting there. The men on leave crowded together, pushing one another. An MP shouted commands. They all had to get out again and form up. Then they were led to the next car, where there were wounded sitting too. They were allowed to enter. Graber found a place in the middle. He did not want to sit by the window. He knew what bomb splinters could do. The train did not start. It was dark in the compartment. They were all waiting. Outside, things grew quiet, but the train continued to stand still. They could see two MPs leading a soldier between them. A troop of Russians was moving cases of ammunition. Then came a couple of SS men talking together loudly. Still, the train did not move. The wounded were the first to begin cursing. They could afford to. For the time being, nothing more could happen to them. Graber leaned his head back. He tried to go to sleep with the intention of waking up when the train was moving, but he could not do it. He kept listening to every sound. He saw the eyes of the others in the dark. The dim light coming from snow and stars outside made them gleam. It was not bright enough to distinguish faces, only the eyes. The compartment was full of darkness and restless eyes, and between them shimmered the dead white of the bandages. The train gave a jerk and stopped again immediately. Shouts were heard. After a while, there was a banging of doors. Two stretchers were taken out on the platform. Two more dead. Two more places for the living, Graber thought. If only no new ones come at the last minute so that we will have to get out. They all thought the same. The train jerked again. The platform began to slide past slowly. Military police, prisoners, SS men, piles of crates, and then suddenly the plane was there. Everyone was bending forward. They still did not believe it. The train would stop again, but it moved and moved, and by degrees, the irregular thrusts were transformed into an even rhythm. They saw tanks and cannons, troops that stared after the cars. All at once, Graber was very tired. Home, he thought. Going home. Oh, God, I don't dare rejoice. In the morning, it was snowing. They stopped at a station to get coffee. The station stood on the edge of a small city of which nothing much remained. Bodies were carried out. The train was being shunted. Graber ran back to his compartment with his ersatz coffee. He did not dare leave it to get bread. A group of MPs started through the train, picking out the less seriously wounded. They were to stay in the local hospital. The news ran swiftly through the cars. The men with arm wounds rushed to the toilets to hide themselves. They fought for the place inside. In a fury, they pulled each other out at the very minute the door was about to be locked. They're coming! Someone shouted suddenly from outside. The crowd dispersed. Two pushed their way into the same toilet and slammed the door. Another, who had fallen in the fracas, stared at his splinted arm. There was a small red spot growing larger. A third opened the door that faced away from the platform and clambered painfully out into the blizzard. He pressed himself against the outside of the train. The rest kept their seats. Shut the door, someone said. Otherwise they'll know at once what's happened. Graber pulled the door shut. For a moment through the eddying snow, he saw the white face of the man who was clinging below. I want to get home, said the wounded man whose bandage was bleeding. Twice I've been in one of these damn field hospitals, and each time right out to the front again, without any leave at all. I want to get back home. I've earned it. He stared with hatred at the healthy men on leave. No one answered. It took a long time for the patrol to arrive. Three men were going through the compartments, while outside a couple of others watched over the wounded who had been told to stay. One of the examiners was a junior field surgeon. He glanced swiftly at the certificates of the wounded. Get out, he said indifferently, already examining another slip. One of the men did not get up. He was small and gray. Out, Grandpa, said the MP who accompanied the surgeon. Didn't you hear? The man stayed where he was. He had a shoulder bandage. Out! Get out! Repeated the MP. The man did not move. He kept his lips pressed together and stared straight ahead as though he understood nothing. The MP stood straddle-legged in front of him. Do you need a special invitation? Stand up! The man went on as though he had not heard. Stand up!
snorted the MP. Can't you see a superior is talking to you? Ma'am, do you want to be court-martialed?
Take it easy, said the young surgeon. First, take it easy.
He had a rosy face without eyelashes. You're bleeding, he explained to the man who had been fighting at the door of the toilet. You must have a fresh bandage. Get out.
All right,
the man began. Then he saw that a second MP had entered and together with the first had taken hold of the gray soldier by his uninjured arm. They were lifting him. The soldier emitted a thin shriek without moving his face. The second MP now seized him around the hips and pushed him out of the compartment like a light package. He did it impersonally, without brutality. The soldier did not go on shrieking either. He disappeared into the herd outside.
Well?
Asked the young surgeon.
Can I go on with the train when I've been bandaged, Captain?
Asked the bleeding man.
We'll see about that. Possibly. First, you must be bandaged.
The man got out with a face full of misery. He had addressed the junior surgeon as captain, and even that had not helped. The MP tried the door to the toilet.
Of course, he said contemptuously. Nothing else ever occurs to them. Always the same thing. Open up, he commanded. At once!
The door opened. One of the soldiers came out.
You're a sly one, aren't you? Growled the MP. Why did you shut yourself in there? Trying to play hide and seek?
I have diarrhea, and I believe that's what a toilet's for.
So, just at this moment, am I supposed to believe that?
The soldier pushed back his coat. The Iron Cross, first class, hung there. He looked at the MP's chest, which was empty.
Yes, he replied calmly. You're supposed to believe that.
The MP got red. The doctor intervened.
Get out, please,
he said without looking at the soldier.
You haven't looked to see what's the matter with me. I can tell from your bandage. Get out, please.
The soldier smiled thinly.
All right. Well then, we're through here, eh?
The surgeon asked the MP nervously.
Yes, sir.
The MP glanced at the man on leave. Each of them was holding his papers in his hand.
Yes, sir, all through, he announced, and climbed out after the doctor.
The door of the toilet opened silently. A lance corporal who had been inside slipped out. His face was steaming with sweat. He slid down on a seat.
Has he gone?
He whispered after a while.
Seems so.
The lance corporal sat for a long while in silence. Sweat ran down his face.
I'm going to pray for him,
he said finally. Everyone looked up.
What? One of them asked incredulously. You're going to pray for that swine of an MP?
No, not for the swine. For the man who was with me in the toilet. He told me to stay there. He would fix things up. Where is he?
Outside. He fixed things up all right. He made the fat pig so mad he didn't look any further.
I'm going to pray for him.
Oh, all right. Pray if you like.
Yes, definitely. My name is Lutyens. I'm certainly going to pray for him.
All right, now shut up. Pray tomorrow, or at least wait until the train has started,
someone said, bored.
I'm going to pray. I have to get home. I'll not get any leave to go home if I'm put in the hospital here. I must get to Germany. My wife has cancer. She's 36, just 36 last October. 4 months in bed already.
He looked at them one after the other with tormented eyes. No one said anything. It was too common a matter. An hour later, the train went on. The man who had climbed out the door had not shown himself again. Probably they had grabbed him, Graeber thought. At noon, a non-commissioned officer came in.
Does anyone here want a shave?
What?
A shave. I'm a barber. I have excellent soap, left over from France.
A shave while the train is moving?
Of course. I've just been working in the officer's car.
How much does it cost?
50 pfennigs. Half a Reichsmark. Cheap when you consider I have to cut off your beards first.
Fine,
someone brought out the money.
But if you cut me, you don't get anything.
The barber set down his shaving bowl and produced from his pocket a pair of scissors and a comb. He had a big paper bag into which he threw the hair. Then he began to work up a lather. He was standing beside a window. The foam was as white as though he were using snow for soap. He was adroit. Three men had themselves shaved. The wounded refused. Graeber was the fourth to sit down. He looked at the three who were finished. They looked strange now. Their faces were red and spotted from the weather. Underneath shone their white chins. They were half soldiers' faces and half the faces of stay-at-homes. Graeber heard the scraping of the razor. Being shaved made him more cheerful. It was already a bit of home, especially since a superior was serving him. The effect was like being in civilian clothes. In the afternoon, they stopped once more. A field kitchen stood outside. They got out to receive their portions. Lütjens did not go with them. Graeber saw that he was moving his lips rapidly. As he did so, he held his uninjured right hand as though folded into the other invisible one. The left was bandaged and hung inside his tunic. They got Swedish turnips. They were lukewarm. It was evening when they came to the border. The train was emptied. The men on leave were assembled and taken to a delousing station. They turned over their clothes and sat around naked in the barracks to let their body lice die. The room was warm. The water was warm, and there was soap that smelled strongly of carbolic. For the first time in months, Graeber was sitting in a really warm room. At the front, there had sometimes been ovens, but then it was always just the side you turned to the heat that was warm. The other was icy. Here, the whole room was warm. One's bones could finally thaw out. One's bones and one's skull. It was the skull that had been frostbound longest. They sat around and looked for lice and cracked them. Graeber had no head lice. Blanket lice and clothing lice did not invade the head. That was an old rule. Lice respected one another's territory. They had no wars. The warmth made him drowsy. He saw the pale bodies of his comrades, the chilblains on their feet and the red lines of scars. They were suddenly no longer soldiers. Their uniforms were hanging somewhere in the steam. They were naked human beings cracking lice, and their conversation became immediately different. They no longer talked about the war. They talked about food and women. "She has a child," said a man called Bernhardt. He was sitting beside Graeber and was catching the lice in his eyebrows with the aid of a pocket mirror. "I haven't been home for 2 years and the child is 4 months old. She claims it's 14 months old and mine, but my mother has written me that it was fathered by a Russian. Besides, she only began to write about it 10 months ago, never before. What do you think?"
"That sort of thing happens," a bald-headed man replied indifferently. "In the country, there are a lot of children fathered by war prisoners."
"I'd kick the woman out," declared a man who was rebandaging his feet. "It's an obscenity."
"Obscenity? What do you mean, obscenity?" The bald head waved contemptuously.
"In wartime, things like that are not the same. You have to understand that. What is it, a boy or a girl?"
"A boy. She writes he looks like me." "If it's a boy, you can keep it. It'll be useful. On a farm, one always needs help."
"But look, he's half Russian."
"What difference? The Russians are Aryans, and the fatherland needs soldiers." Bernhardt put away his mirror.
"It's not as simple as that. It's easy for you to talk. You're not the one it happened to."
"Would you prefer it if some fat, reconditioned native bull gave your wife a child?"
"Certainly not that."
"All right, then."
"She might have waited for me,"
Bernhardt said softly and embarrassedly.
The bald head shrugged his shoulders.
"Some of them wait and some don't. You can't expect everything if you don't get home for years."
"Are you married too?"
"No, thank God I'm not."
"Russians are not Aryans,"
a mouse-like man with a pointed face and a small mouth said suddenly. He had been silent till then. Everyone looked at him.
"You're mistaken," the bald head replied.
"They are Aryans. After all, they were once our allies." "They're subhumans, Bolshevik subhumans.
That's the definition.
You're mistaken. Poles, Czechs, and French are subhumans. We are freeing the Russians from the communists. They are Aryans, with the exception of the communists, of course. Perhaps not master Aryans like us, simply Aryan workers, but they're not to be exterminated. The mouse was taken aback.
They were always subhumans, he declared. I know that for sure. Pure subhumans.
That was changed long ago, just like the Japanese. They too are Aryans now, since they're our allies, yellow Aryans.
You're both wrong, said the extraordinarily hairy Bass. The Russians were not subhuman while they were still our allies, but they are now. That's the way it stands.
Then what is he to do with the child?
Hand it over to the state, said the mouse with new authority. Painless mercy death. What else?
And his wife?
That's up to the authorities. Branding, head shaving, penitentiary, concentration camp, or gallows.
They haven't done anything to her so far, Bernhard said.
The authorities probably don't know about it yet.
They know. My mother reported it.
Then they are dirty and corrupt. They belong in a concentration camp, too.
Oh, damn it all, leave me in peace, Bernhard cried, suddenly furious, and turned away.
A bandy-legged, pigeon-chested man, who had been wandering restlessly through the room, came up to them and stopped.
We are supermen, he said, and the others are subhuman. That much is clear. But who now are the ordinary men?
The bald head reflected.
Swedes, he said presently. Or Swiss.
Savages, announced the Bass.
White savages, of course.
White savages don't exist anymore, said the mouse.
No?
The Bass stared at him hard. Graeber dozed off. He heard the others starting to talk about women again. He didn't know much about them. The race theories of his country did not correspond very well with what he understood of love. He did not want to get it all mixed up with natural selection, family trees, and the ability to bear children. As a soldier, he had scarcely known anything but a few whores in the countries where he had fought. They had been just as matter-of-fact as the members of the German Maidens Guild. But with them, at least it was a profession. They got their clothes back and dressed. All at once, they were privates, lance corporals, sergeants, and non-coms again. The man with the Russian child turned out to be a non-com. The Bass as well. The mouse was a convoy soldier. He shrank into himself when he saw that the others were non-coms. Graeber examined his tunic. It was still warm and smelled of acid. Under the clasp of the braces, he found a colony of lice that had taken refuge there. They were dead. Gassed. He scratched them away. They were conducted into a barracks. A political officer delivered an address. He stood on a podium, behind which hung a picture of the Führer, and he explained to them that now, since they were going back to the homeland, they had a great responsibility. Nothing must be mentioned about their time at the front. Nothing about positions, locations, troop disposal, or troop movements. Spies were lying in wait everywhere. Therefore, silence was of the utmost importance. Whoever talked loosely could count on severe punishment. Idle criticism, too, was treason. The Führer was conducting the war. He knew what he was doing. The situation was brilliant. The Russians were bleeding to death. They had suffered unprecedented losses, and the counterattack was being mounted. Care of the troops was first class, and their spirit excellent. Once more, to divulge the names of places or the position of troops was high treason. Alarmism also. The Gestapo was on the alert everywhere. Everywhere. The officer paused. Then he explained in an altered tone that the Führer, despite his immense task, kept watch over all his soldiers. He had specified that each man on leave was to receive a gift to take back home with him. For this purpose, food packages would be issued to them. They were to be handed over to their families at home as evidence that the troops abroad were well cared for and that they could even bring back presents. Anyone who opened his packet on the way and ate it himself would be punished. There would be an inspection at each destination to make sure. Heil Hitler!
They stood at attention. Graeber expected Deutschland, Deutschland über alles and the Horst Wessel song. The Third Reich was great on songs, but nothing happened. Instead came the order.
Men with furloughs to the Rhineland, 3 steps forward.
A few men stepped in front of the line.
Furloughs to the Rhineland are canceled, announced the officer.
He turned to the man standing nearest him.
Where do you want to go instead?
To Cologne.
I have just told you that the Rhineland is restricted. Where do you want to go instead?
To Cologne, said the man uncomprehendingly. I come from Cologne.
You cannot go to Cologne, do you understand? To what other city do you want to go?
No other city. My wife and children are in Cologne. I was a locksmith there. My furlough certificate is stamped for Cologne.
I see that, but you cannot go there. Try to understand. For the time being, Cologne is forbidden to men on leave.
Forbidden? Asked the former locksmith. Why?
Have you gone crazy, man? Whose business is it to ask questions? Yours or the authorities?
A captain came up and whispered something to the officer. He nodded.
Men with furloughs to Hamburg and Alsace, step forward, he commanded.
No one stepped forward.
Rhinelanders, remain here. The rest at ease. Left about face. Step up and receive your homecoming packages.
They were standing in the station once more. The Rhinelanders joined them after a while.
What was up? Asked the Bass.
You heard what it was.
You can't go to Cologne? Where are you going now?
To Rothenburg. I have a sister there. What am I to do in Rothenburg? I live in Cologne. What's going on in Cologne? Why can't I go to Cologne?
Careful,
someone said and glanced at 2 SS men who were striding by with thudding boots.
To hell with them. What am I to do in Rothenburg? Where's my family? They were in Cologne. What is happening there?
Perhaps your family is in Rothenburg, too.
They're not in Rothenburg. There is no place for them there. My wife and my sister can't stand each other. What is going on in Cologne?
The locksmith stared at the others. He had tears in his eyes. His thick lips quivered.
Why can you go home and I can't? After all this time, what has happened? What has become of my wife and my children? Georga is my eldest's name, 11 years old. What has happened?
Listen, said the Bass. You can't do anything about it. Send your wife a telegram. Have her come to Rothenburg. Otherwise, you won't see her at all.
And the trip? Who will pay for that? And where is she to stay?
If they won't let you into Cologne, they won't let your wife out, said the Mouse. That's certain. That's the way regulations are.
The locksmith opened his mouth but said nothing. Only after a time he asked,
Why not?
Think it out for yourself.
The locksmith looked around. He glanced from one to another.
Everything can't have gone to pieces. That's absolutely impossible.
Be glad they didn't send you straight back to the front, said the Bass. That could very well have happened once your district is barred.
Graeber listened in silence. He realized that he was shivering and that the cold did not come from outside. Once more, the ghostly and intangible something was there that had haunted him so long and that could never be wholly grasped, that eluded him and came back and stared at him and had 100 ill-defined faces and no face at all. He looked at the rails. They led toward home, security, warmth, and peace, toward the only thing that was left. And now the something from outside seemed to have slipped in with him. It breathed eerily beside him and was not to be frightened away.
Furlough, said the man from Cologne bitterly. This is my furlough. What now?
The others looked at him and said nothing.
It was as though a hidden sickness had suddenly shown itself in him. He was innocent, but he seemed to be strangely marked, and imperceptibly they edged away. They were glad it had not struck them, but they weren't safe yet themselves, and for that reason they edged away. Misfortune was contagious. The train rolled slowly into the train shed. It was black, and it blotted out the last of the light.